So our passage this evening, as we continue in this series, The Night Before Calvary, is that one which we read, John chapter 16, verses 12-18. And the theme of this section is closely related to the theme of the previous section that we looked at last week. In verse 8, you may remember, Jesus says, "When he comes, he there being the helper, the Spirit." And now in verse 13, Jesus says, "When the Spirit of truth comes." So you can see the similarity of language and of theme between those two verses, verses 8 and 13. So both last week's passage then and this week's passage are about what the Spirit is going to do when he comes. They're about the work of the Spirit in these last days in this new covenant era. Is there any difference then between these two sections, last week's and this week's? Well, yes, there is. Last week's passage focused on the Spirit's work in relation to the world. Remember, we saw he exposes things. He exposes the foulness of the world's sin. He exposes the flimsiness of the world's righteousness. And he exposes the falseness of the world's judgment about God. This week's passage, however, focuses on the Spirit's work in relation to the apostles, which of course represents a much narrower focus. The apostles are a very specific group of men, and they'll only be around for a few decades. But it's the Spirit's work amongst those men for that period of time that this evening's text is interested in. And I have three headings for you. And first of all, then, the Spirit's guidance. The Spirit's guidance. One of Talitha's friends at school has this irritating habit. She emerges from every test or exam she ever does, saying how hard it was and how badly she did, before then going on to receive an absolutely fantastic mark for that test or that exam. And in the early days then, coming out of the exam room, Talitha and others would take this girl at face value and be relieved that she too had found the thing difficult. But after a while, as the girl consistently passed with flying colours, these tests that supposedly she had struggled with so much, they stopped taking her at face value. They would just roll their eyes at her post-exam remarks and take them with a pinch of salt. Now, think of the men who are with Jesus here in the upper room. Some of them we know very little about. But three of them we know became best-selling authors. Matthew, who wrote Matthew's Gospel. Peter, who wrote the first epistle of Peter and the second epistle of Peter. And John, who almost certainly wrote John's Gospel, 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and the book of Revelation. That's a pretty impressive array, isn't it, of literary works. The writings of those three men have been read by millions. They have played a part, I think we can say, in shaping whole societies and cultures over the last 2,000 years. They have generated shelves and shelves of weighty commentaries. Augustine has grappled with the writings of those men. John Calvin has grappled with the writings of those men. Don Carson has grappled with the writings of those men. Indeed, people have gained PhDs for their research on a single line, a single word even, from the writings of those men, because those three men were formidably deep thinkers. Their combined theological IQ, incalculable. And when, therefore, verse 12 here is somewhat unflattering about the apostles, somewhat unflattering about their ability to comprehend things and take things in, we're tempted to react like Talitha reacts to that girl at school. We're tempted to roll our eyes here. These men struggle to comprehend and take things in. My foot, they do. These are some of the greatest theologians that the world will ever see. This description of them here in verse 12, it has to be taken with a pinch of salt, surely. we're tempted to react like that. But at this point, we must jump to the end of our passage, to verses 17 and 18. And what do we see there? What's going on in verses 17 and 18? Well, quite clearly, the apostles are struggling to comprehend things and take things in. That's what's going on, and I mean really struggling. All Jesus says is, a little while and you will see me no longer, and again a little while and you will see me. I mean, it's not like he's probing there the mysteries of the doctrine of election or something, is it? I reckon Anna or Rachel could explain that he's talking there about his death and his resurrection. And okay, Anna and Rachel and the rest of us have the benefit of hindsight. These men don't, of course, but that doesn't really excuse their incomprehension. Ever since Caesarea Philippi and that passage we looked at last Sunday morning, Jesus has been pretty plain and unequivocal about his death and resurrection. They ought to get the reference here in verse 16. And then, I am going to the Father, which they quote in a bemused way at the end of verse 17. Again, that's not obscure, is it? From the earliest days of his ministry, Jesus has taught them to pray, Our Father in heaven, ... Consistently, according to this gospel, he has described himself as one sent into the world by the Father. It's pretty obvious, therefore, that I am going to the Father means I am going to heaven, back to the one who originally sent me into the world. I'm saying it's not the finer details of things that the apostles are scratching their heads over in verses 17 and 18. It's not the hardcore profundities of Christian doctrine. It's the ABC. It's the basics. It's Sunday school stuff. In response to some very, very elementary words from Jesus' lips, they complain in verse 18, we don't know what he's talking about. And my point is then, in the light of verses 17 and 18, we shouldn't take verse 12 with a pinch of salt. Verse 12 isn't actually an excessively modest description of these men. It's not that they're being portrayed there as clueless men when in reality they're theological geniuses. No, they are clueless men. The portrayal of them in verse 12 is accurate. They're so clueless they can't even get the notion of Jesus leaving them in his death and then reappearing shortly after in his resurrection. They can't even get the notion of Jesus returning into the presence of God in a short while. Which raises the question then, how did they later become so learned? So erudite? So switched on to the nuances of Christian doctrine? How did that happen? Did they undergo a brain transplant or something? Did they sign up for weekly head massages to stimulate their grey matter? No. Look at verse 13. When the Spirit of truth comes, he will guide you into all the truth. How did Matthew and Peter and John get from being so gormless in the upper room to writing things like, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God? The Spirit's guidance. That's how. These men weren't naturally and innately and automatically world-changing thinkers. No, they became world-changing thinkers through the work of the Spirit. And it's a reminder then that you can never categorically rule out for yourself some role or other in Christ's service. You know the kind of thing. I could never be a preacher because the tone of my voice sends people to sleep. I could never be a missionary overseas because I'm rubbish at languages. I could never be a decent Christian parent because I have absolutely no patience with children. I could never tell a stranger about Jesus because I'm a dyed-in-the-wool introvert. Now, you can't say those things because you just don't know. You just don't know what the Spirit might do with you. Matthew might reasonably have said, I could never write a New Testament gospel because I don't even understand the words a little while and you'll see me no longer. John might reasonably have said, don't consider me God when you're headhunting an author for the book of Revelation, because even the words I am going to the Father are too much for my puny little brain to get around. But you see, the Spirit took these men, these dimwits of John chapter 16. The Spirit took those men under his wing. He decided that they were going to be his channels for communicating to the world the meaty, elaborate, intricate doctrines of the Christian gospel. And the rest, as we say, is history. And in a similar way, the Spirit might just have tasks lined up for you, believer, which right now would seem utterly unthinkable. Never say never. The Spirit's guidance. Secondly, the Spirit's glorifying. The Spirit's glorifying. So this truth then, into which the Spirit will guide these men, what will be its content? Will Matthew, under the Spirit's guidance, write about the digestive system of the barnacle goose? Will Peter, under the Spirit's guidance, write about the geometrical properties of the Egyptian pyramids? Will John, under the Spirit's guidance, write about the science of cooking a perfect omelette? All of that is the truth. Indeed, all of that is worthy material for a Spirit-filled man or woman to write about. But none of that is what the Spirit will lead these men to write about. No, he will lead these men to write about Jesus. And not about how Jesus dressed, or what his favourite fruit was, or what time he liked to go to bed at night. He will lead them to write about how great and beautiful and worthy of devotion Jesus is. As Jesus himself puts it in verse 14, he, that's the Spirit, will glorify me. The Spirit will declare things to you apostles about me, Jesus says. Things that you will write down. And consequently, throughout the coming centuries and millennia, people will read what you have written down about me, and it will cause them to gasp. And it will cause them to tremble. And it will cause them to bow their knees and surrender their lives to me. The Spirit will glorify me in what he steers you to write down, Jesus says. But that raises a question. An enormous question. A question over which whole religions like Judaism and Islam stumble. And the question is this: how is that not idolatrous? How is that not idolatrous? Surely God alone should be glorified. Surely these men should be writing about how great and beautiful and worthy of devotion God is. Surely it's in that direction the Spirit should be prompting the apostles as they put pen to paper. Surely that should be the Spirit's great burden, his great concern, his great passion, glorifying God, not glorifying a Galilean man. However noble and virtuous that Galilean man may be, however willing to wash people's feet and do all sorts of gallant things he may be, the Spirit ought to know better. When in former days he inspired prophets and psalmists to write things down, his concern then wasn't glorifying men. You don't read those works, their works, and gasp at how great Moses is, or how great Daniel is, or how great Abraham is. It's always how great God is. The Spirit has never been interested in glorifying anyone else except God. So what's this change now in his ministry all about? Why, as he directs the labours of the apostles in the coming years, will spotlighting Jesus, Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus Mary's son, be the name of the game? How is that not idolatrous? That's the question. Well, in verse 15, Jesus answers the question. Therefore, I said that he will take what is mine and declare it to you. So he's here vindicating the Spirit. He's vindicating the fact that the Spirit is going to be consumed with glorifying him. He's explaining there in verse 15 why it's appropriate for the Spirit to take what is his and declare it to the apostles. Why it's appropriate for the Spirit to be focused on glorifying this Galilean man, Jesus. Why that is not idolatrous. And so what is the explanation? What is the bit? Well, it's a short line comprising seven words. But let me tell you, this line is epic. This line is momentous. I can't stress this enough. The whole validity of Christianity rests on this line at the beginning of John 16, verse 15. You can't say that about every line in the Bible. Indeed, there are lots and lots of lines in the Bible that you can't say that about. Every line is important. Every line has a role to play. Every line is worth reading. But not every line in the Bible is critical to the validity of Christianity. But this one is. If this line isn't true, then our opening hymn this evening, "When You Remember We Worship Jesus Christ," it was blasphemy. If this line isn't true, then when earlier in the service we prayed to Jesus Christ, we were committing blasphemy. If this line isn't true, then Christianity itself is a hellish false religion which for 2,000 years now has been a stench in the nostrils of the living God. That's how big this line is. So what is it? "All that the Father has is mine." That's the line. "All that the Father has is mine." And Jesus means there is no reason for glorifying the Father that does not equally apply to me. That's what he's saying. There is no reason for glorifying the Father that does not equally apply to me. If you want that fleshed out, Donald MacLeod helpfully fleshes it out in terms of four categories. So number one, all the grand titles the Father possesses are also Christ titles. Christ is God. Christ is Lord. Christ is I Am. Christ is the Alpha and the Omega. Number two, all the grand functions the Father possesses are also Christ functions. Christ is creator. Christ is sustainer. Christ is judge. Number three, all the grand attributes the Father possesses are also Christ's attributes. Christ is eternal. Christ is almighty. And then number four, all the grand prerogatives the Father possesses are also Christ's prerogatives. Most of all, worship. Christ is worshipped. That's what Jesus is saying here. All that the Father has is mine. All the Father's titles are mine. All the Father's attributes are mine. All the Father's functions are mine. All the Father's prerogatives are mine. And that's why then, as the Spirit guides you apostles what to say, what to write, he will do so with this overriding agenda, glorifying me. And they won't be committing idolatry one single little bit in having that agenda. No. They will be within the bounds of absolute propriety, because all that the Father has is mine. And let me just say this before we move on to our final point this evening. If this line then, "all that the Father has is mine," if this line is true, then Christianity, in the form that it has taken over these 2,000 years, centered upon the worship of Jesus Christ, Christianity is exonerated, if this line is true. Worshipping Jesus is not profane. And it's not idolatrous, and it's not outrageous, and it's not blasphemous if this line is true. But we must go further than that, actually, mustn't we? And we must say that if this line is true, then in fact not worshipping Jesus is profane and outrageous. And I suppose at this point I could spend a few minutes railing against Judaism and Islam and the Jehovah's Witnesses, etc., etc., but there wouldn't be much point in doing that. And it may be the case then that you this evening are none of those things. You belong to none of those movements. You may just be an ordinary person whose life revolves around work or family or retirement plans or Newcastle United or whatever it may be. But it doesn't revolve around Jesus Christ. You have no problem with Jesus Christ, no particular disrespect for Jesus Christ, but your life does not revolve around Jesus Christ. You don't live to worship and to glorify him. Well, I could talk to you this evening about how attractive Jesus is and about how desirable Jesus is and about how you should become a Christian on that basis. And often I talk like that from this lectern. But this evening, because this is my text, I just want to say to you, he's your God. And that's a fact. He's your God. The whole cosmos, let alone your 70 or 80 years of life on this earth, the whole cosmos exists to glorify him. He's too grand and eminent not to worship. You've got to do it. You've got to do it. And from this evening then, I urge you, make Jesus Christ the center of your life. It's not a lifestyle choice. It's not a preference. It's not a taste. It's response to the fact that everything divine exists in him. He is holy God. It's just simply responding to that. You've got to do it. Make Jesus Christ, your God, the center of your life. The Spirit's guidance, the Spirit's glorifying, but then one last thing this evening, the Spirit's goal. The Spirit's goal. And I'm interested here in the middle bit of verse 13 that we haven't touched upon yet. He will not speak on his own authority, but whatever he hears, he will speak. And all that means then is that the Spirit won't do his own thing. He won't pursue his own private goal. He won't be a loose cannon, doing and saying some things that raise an eyebrow or two amongst the other persons of the Godhead. No, the Spirit's goal will be nothing other than the Father's goal and the Son's goal. It will not deviate by so much as a millimeter. Because, you see, that is how the triune God operates. There are no tensions. There are no cracks. There are no competing agendas within God, the Holy Trinity. The three persons are always wholly aligned, each making his own contribution in a way that complements perfectly the other's contributions. It's so different, isn't it, from what we've seen in the political realm over the last couple of weeks. I saw footage the other day of all the Labour MPs all together following their spectacular general election victory 2 years ago, and they were all smiling with each other, and there were lots of hugs going on between them and all the rest of it. It was one big happy family. But now, in the last couple of weeks, we've had Wes Streeting launching out, pursuing his own goal of leading the party. And signs that Angela Rayner may do something similar. And suddenly it isn't the focused, unified movement that it seemed to be 2 years ago. There are all these figures within it whose private ambitions are now coming to the surface. Now, my point there is not to bash the Labour Party. We've seen the same thing often over the years in other political parties too, haven't we? No, my point simply is that there is something exquisitely unique about God. Something that you don't see amongst men, that you don't see in human organizations, whether political parties or anything else. What we're seeing in the Labour Party, you just don't get that amongst the divine persons. Individual egos never assert themselves within the Trinity. Now, each person always wants and aims for exactly what the others want and are aiming for. And our response to that then should be, first of all, adoration. What a God this is. This Trinity of ours. What a God. No tensions. They've existed together for eternity. Surely at some point, in all that time, some tensions have got to emerge. No tensions, no cracks, no competing agendas. Never, ever, ever. And so that should be our first response to this wonderful truth. Just adoration of this uniquely, incomparably beautiful God. But then also, being a Trinitarian church, that is a church centered upon the Trinity, we surely should look a little bit like the Trinity. That is to say, we should be a church where there aren't ambitious individuals wanting to hijack the whole thing. Sadly, there have been lots of churches where that's happened, haven't there? You've heard of them. You've perhaps been in them over the years, where ambitious individuals have hijacked the whole thing, where the Wes Streeting phenomenon has at some point kicked in. No, we should be a church rather where our goal is absolutely one and the same. May Jesus Christ be praised. May we decrease and he increase. And so may NREC then ever be a place free from big egos doing their own thing. If even God the Son wasn't a big ego who went off and did his own thing, if even God the Spirit wasn't a big ego who went off and did his own thing, then there's no excuse for any of us being a big ego that goes off and does our own thing. May we ever be a church free of competing agendas, a place that reflects the harmonious cooperativeness of Father and Son and Spirit. May people who come in from the outside, though they may not realize it at first and certainly wouldn't be able to express it at first, may they actually be seeing a little glimpse of the Trinity when they come amongst us. Because our inner life as a church reflects something of the inner life of the triune God. That's a beautiful thing when that's the case. May it be so. Here, the Spirit's goal, so wonderfully in keeping, in accordance with the goal of the Father and the Son, all on the same page, all on the same wavelength. May something of that Spirit, small s now, characterize our church and every church. What an impact we would have, wouldn't we, on society, if our churches were Trinitarian in that way, not just in our creeds, not just in our hymns and our prayers, although I wish they were more so, but in our very relationships with each other. If we were Trinitarian in that practical, existential sense, what an impact that might have on the world around us. May God help us to be so. Amen. Well, let's close.